You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. And my 2023 has been a little rocky. As I was doing this last week, my wife was on the operating table, and for appendicitis, and the blockage was malignant, but this has all been removed and dealt with a very, very, very young and very slow growth. So it's been an interesting 2023 so far, but everything as it stands now is perfectly okay. If I was a little distracted last week, I'm sorry about that, but as soon as I finished, I just ran off to the hospital. Anyway, I also encourage you to check out my books on this and other pages, my Patreon account, and certainly direct donations in the Orthodox Medievalist icon, and of course support Radio Albion as well. Oh, and I keep forgetting to mention the merchandising, which is still around. Sales were big in the beginning, but kind of withdrew. So whatever you can do, I truly appreciate it. You know, the topic that we're dealing with, especially today, you know, the political theory of someone like St. Philaret sometimes seems mysterious, even to people like us, because we are so far from this. There is no conception today of self-rule, let alone any political rule based on justice or virtue. Because we live in the Tower of Babel, there is no standard for anything except one that is enforced by the regime. That's simply based on economic self-interest. We, of course, live in a monopoly controlled by the BlackRock organization. And it shouldn't surprise you that in my China book, which I'm about 50% finished with, BlackRock plays a huge role. But why St. Philaret? St. Philaret lived in the 19th century, the very end of the 18th, and throughout the 19th century. So he was witness to the conclusion of the French Revolution via Napoleon. And it was almost like being born in the time of troubles. He knew the extreme violence that the West had in store for Russia, whether it be Napoleon, whether it be Crimea, and on to our own day, where, you know, my worst nightmare comes true as Russia then is depicted not just as an opponent, but some sort of a radical evil. If you remember, the regime never used the word evil until the Oklahoma City bombing. I distinctly remember that. Once their opponents start organizing, suddenly they are supporters of censorship and a police state. And today, of course, we live in a system where every aspect of our life is either observed, listened to, spied on, or otherwise regulated. So, St. Philaret, because he's a modern person, this is why the new martyrs are so interesting, because he's from the modern era rather than from the patristic era, for example, he speaks in a language that we understand. It shouldn't surprise anybody that, in terms of translation, everything I've read of Filaret is not in English. If it's been translated, I'm not aware of it. So I've been spending quite a bit of time going through some of his works and doing the best I can to piece it together, despite the 19th century conventions. But because of the fact that he lived in a revolutionary time, Filaret was always very focused on political and moral virtue. And his purpose was to uphold the traditional Orthodox point of view of the state, which is not the same thing as government, and is not the same thing as a royal family. This is why using these words can be very, very confusing. The state is the ontological principle of order. There's always been a tension, and not just his, but Orthodox royalism, and royalism is integral to Orthodoxy, because it's a mirror of the heavenly realm, tension between the fact that the crown is, royal rule is generated by sin, while at the same time the best means of containing it. I bring up the concept of natural law all the time. I can't conceive of a form of Christianity other than the most bankrupt Protestant versions, or worse, that dispenses with natural law. And Plato, is our source, although he never quite used the precise phrase like Aristotle did. But because the universe is orderly, because natural laws in terms of scientific laws can be discerned, those concepts, those principles that we can discern that make it an ordered whole are natural law. Now, the modern version of it very conveniently dropped the state and moral principle out of the equation. The Enlightenment at its core was that we can be precise in terms of, mathematics and scientific rigor, but when it comes to why we're doing this or what we're going to do with it, all of a sudden it's all muddied. And once the natural law idea and traditional restraints were removed, as it was, from the French Revolution really to the 1950s, then, of course, they could impose their own set of so-called virtues. Now, of course, they're not virtues. Whenever you define something in this realm, it's towards the good. Thomas Aquinas held that the ultimate foundational principle of ethics is found in the law of nature, which is that evil is to be avoided and good to be pursued. In other words, being is good, and whatever either destroys or perverts it, pervert meaning to turn away from, is the very principle of evil. You can't have a criminal can't be virtuous. He also can't be rational. He can be logical. But this is all a matter of the most vulgar self-interest. What St. Filaret and a handful of, especially in Russia, offer is a specific natural law doctrine that deals both with politics, ethics, and of course our life struggling against our opponents. Of course, Filaret, while he was aware of the French Revolution and what occurred there, of course died long before the Bolsheviks came to power, and did not live under a state that was totalitarian. Only liberalism and Marxism produce totalitarian states, meaning where everything, even the nationalist governments in the early 20th century were highly limited. They didn't have the technological apparatus that the regime does today. And there was a distinct split between capital on the one hand and the state on the other. There is no, natural law is essentially the realm of Plato's forms. So, and the first concept, and this is something that he has offered, and is a Russian contribution, is that there's not the opposition between the earthly fatherland and the heavenly one. Now, this has a lot to do with where we're from. Philaret lived in a time relatively healthy, in fact, utopian, compared to what we have now. We have, those of you who are familiar with the novel Logan's Run, we are very much a part of that dystopia planned for a very long time. No, that distinction doesn't exist. The earthly fatherland, that is the nation, and the heavenly fatherland is a single unity. God, Trinity, dominates both, and they're both subject to a single law, although, of course, the application is very different. So in order to maintain this unity, which is the ultimate principle of rule, state and those who make up the state have to be self-controlled. They have to rule themselves first. And I talked about this to great extent last week. But he also lived at a time where one of the biggest issues, the big issues were serfdom and certainly the synodal system, which all the saints of this era had condemned. What makes Metropolitan Philaret worthwhile, specifically in the political realm, is that he shifts attention from the idea of separating the realm of the state. Sometimes we call that the realm of Caesar, and on the one hand, and the realm of God on the other. Rather, they're mutually connected, which is accurate. And of course, this assumes that by Caesar in the New Testament, they're referring to political rule in general, or at least royal rule. Because our definition of the state is very different from theirs. And of course, Americans don't make a distinction between authority and power. Biblical passages are extremely difficult to properly interpret. He lived in a time of essential health. He's one of the people who wrote the edict that liberated the small percentage of serfs that remained in 1861. But he sees the two commandments, give to Caesar what is his and to God what is his. It's just another way of seeing the cosmos as really the need for hierarchical subordination of the earthly to the heavenly. There aren't two sets of laws, although their application and how they're perceived, of course, are different. But their source and very basic axioms are the same. We fulfill duties in relation to the earthly power strictly, and it's really not so much our obligation to the state, but our obligation to the heavenly power. Now, we talked about inner freedom last week. See, when moderns and postmoderns refer to freedom, they're simply talking about the negative, that we're not restrained from doing whatever we feel like at the moment. But of course, that's a very vulgar and specifically liberal definition of freedom. Inner freedom is different. Inner freedom derives from virtue. And it has to do with the second birth. I mean, natural birth comes from physical necessity, but spiritual birth, rebirth, comes from struggle. Christian freedom is true freedom or liberty. The external freedom is simply a realm of temptation. But to make war on that is the very nature of freedom of our soul, internal freedom. This isn't a carnal French revolutionary idea. And we talked about this with Hegel. It's extremely common. But, in 2023, everything is so inverted and vulgarized that you can't even use the same language. The regime is slowly changing the definitions of everything. So the man of inner freedom can live in a hovel as well as live like a monarch and be equally happy. Philaret talks about obedience deriving from humility. obedience derives directly from humility as the centerpiece of all the virtues. And St. Philaret states that, you know, he says, as salt imparts flavor to food, so humility imparts perfection to the virtue. So in other words, without it, whether salt or humility, the food is damaged and spoils. So without humility, virtue is corrupted or not virtue at all. You see, the defense mechanisms that humans have, which the church fathers were well aware of, they were psychologists substantially, realized that defense mechanisms like denial, for example, you can't be conscious of this. Because if you know that you're in denial, well, you're not in denial anymore. And that's what happens as the virtues begin to be corrupted. Pride, vanity, the rule of the passions, the drives rather than reason. And Aristotle was right. I mean, what makes, and even, you know, in the scholastics, what makes us human and of infinite value is the development of reason. And nothing can show humility more than how Christ appeared on earth. Very specifically, in a very important part of the world, but not a well-known part of it, not a well-known place, largely the middle of nowhere, and he had nowhere to go. They were rejected from the inn. This is extremely important. I mean, he appeared in a manger, it's like in a dog's cage, as far as we're concerned, which is an example to everybody. But he is God. If I get upset because somebody who doesn't know anything tries to lecture me, especially if he has any kind of power over me, can you imagine how bad it was for God to have the Jews spit in his face? The perversion of humility is the idea that no, swaddling clothes aren't good enough. I need the most luxurious sheets, and I deserve luxurious sheets. Humility can teach others to be humble, as he would say. And pride, of course, is its negation. Pride does not lead to any virtue. We're not talking about self-respect. Again, that's a linguistic problem. We're talking about the idea that we believe, what we vaguely may call narcissism today. Humility is what makes everything else a virtue. And importantly, humility alone can bring peace to the soul. The minute it no longer is humble, it is constantly being overwhelmed and agitated by every kind of passion, the obsession for whether it be money or reputation. And he even refers to proud philosophizing. And he says, proud philosophizing, with these theories extracted from our earthly nature, rises in the soul like a mist with phantoms of faint light. Let this fog fall into the valley of humility, then only you can see the clear high sky above you. He talks about the movement and the noise of arrogant and restless thoughts and passionate desires, and that's where the soul then defiles itself, and as he says explicitly, deafens itself to the call of virtue. Calm, peace, and true obedience comes from humility and humility alone. The reason we talk about all of this is that one of his cardinal ideas in terms of political philosophy is obedience. It's really hard to obey someone if you're arrogant. That's why monasticism is in such trouble, especially in the West. He says, where there is human society, there must necessarily be a power that unites people into it. For without power, one can imagine only an unorganized multitude of people and not a society. Now, the terms that he's referring not just to power in the sense of external force, but also the right to use external force. And he's using it as a kind of shorthand for both. That society requires both authority and power, and he'll say later on, coming from one entity, not several. But authority, legitimate authority, he says, operates in society and it's preserved through obedience. Therefore, obedience is necessarily connected with the existence of society. He continues and says, whoever would shake or weaken obedience would shake or weaken the foundations of society. Are there many people in society who are capable of obedience according to their ideas and speculations? He says, when I look at experiments, these social experiments, how some peoples and states want to base obedience on these speculations, nothing firm stands. Thrones and altars are shaken, the reins of government are torn, rebellions swarm, vices are shameless, crimes are an insult to justice, and there is no unity. And this is a central statement. It's easy to write like that when you live in the middle of 19th century Russia, which was a country that, well, obviously compared to the 20th century, was in excellent shape, was growing rapidly. It had a tremendous, there was an interruption of Crimea, of course. But Crimea, as Filaret himself says, was not a defeat for Russia, contrary to the myths. There was a time of great optimism. It was a time of relatively virtuous rulers. Again, compared to the 18th century in Russia, and certainly compared to the 20th. The French Revolution, and hence Napoleon, weighed very heavily on St. Filaret. And condemnation of liberalism really became a dogmatic requirement through him. I mean, people knew this to begin with. But when you live in a society like that, obedience is certainly a virtue. The assumption is, because of the nature of that society, obedience is what steers you away from sin. Whereas the French Revolution, which, and of course, St. Filaret lived through the so-called Decembrists, who were the elite oligarchs who attempted to take over the government. And of course, thank God, Nicholas I was able to take over. Constantine, his brother, was a would have been a figurehead for them. But he says, basing obedience on speculations, that's revolutionary doctrine. Revolutionary doctrine, whether it be in the Soviet Union, whether it be in the U.S., because the U.S. is a revolutionary state, especially over the last 50 years, at least post-World War II. Any of the revolutionary societies, nothing ever stays the same. The doctrines that, well, first of all, doctrines that undergird revolution are usually denied. You know, the Soviets in 1916 didn't go around talking about collectivization. They didn't go around talking about burning the churches down. That only happened once they took power. You know, the left in America sometimes will say that Americans aren't ready for, I don't know, whatever, female president, whatever they're talking about. And what does it mean not to be ready for something? It means they haven't been conditioned enough. The left, in general, liberalism in particular, is based on deceit. And if it's based on anything, it's based on the absolute denial of natural law. And Edmund Burke said something very similar. The doctrines of the revolutionary ideologies have nothing to do with natural law, really have nothing to do with truth. It's a matter of one faction seeking power at the expense of another one, using and lying to the population in order to justify it. And one of the reasons is because there at least is some claim to elections. Because elections are a disaster. Of course, he's assuming that elected officials have power rather than economic elites. Maybe he had a claim there, despite the fact that, you know, Royal Russia was very democratic at the local levels, at the industrial level. But party government is loaded with constant instability, searching for things to legitimize itself. And ultimately, if you've ever served on a campaign, no matter who it is, the purpose is, how do we manipulate people into voting for us? There's periods of tremendous struggle. The fact that you can claim, because you have periodic elections, therefore the regime can do what it wants other than that. And in 2023, there are no honest elections. It's a parody in the U.S. So And the assumption, and then St. Philaret, again, talking about humility, says that you have people who specialize in different things, who have a natural bent towards something rather than another. And yet they're being called on to make decisions and vote on the basis of what amounts to very complicated issues. Selling votes is common. You vote for someone because you think you're going to get money out of it. You think you're going to get a program that's going to help you. You know, the fury of passions is a phrase straight from Philaret that underlies the party system and party government is precisely the same fury of passions that's going to destroy it. You're mixing the ignorant with the wise. Again, not a huge problem in Russia during St. Philaret's day. So we need to be very careful. St. Augustine would then contrast the heavenly versus the earthly realm because of the time he lived in. Those who read Plato realize that the doctrine of the forms, you know, that Socrates laid out via Plato came into existence because they had no relation to the society at the time. Both Marxism and capitalism are materialist at root. And materialism only knows cause and effect. Then, of course, but he's living in a healthy time. Then, of course, he talks about the opposition to that. Autocratic power, established, he says, on the age-old law of heredity and renewed when that heredity is impoverished, as he says. And when that doesn't work, it's reinforced, as he says, on a different basis by pure and reasonable election. He's thinking of many of the Russian czars were elected. 1613 stands out, of course. And once decided on, you have a crown that exists in inviolable steadfastness and acts of calm majesty. Then he says this. He says, those who are subject, in other words, those who are subject to the crown, do not think of seeking the right to elect public office at the federal level, because they are sure that the government cares about the common good and understands through whom and how to arrange it. Power, according to the free will and trust of the subjects to the monarch, gives the state the right to elect its own advisors, assigning reasonable limits to it, he said. Now, of course, in Russia, the local level was purely democratic, and especially under Tsar Nicholas II, you know, the commune was the dominant social institution for the overwhelming majority of the population. He lived at a time where you could have faith that the monarch, because of his piety, does believe in the common good. Monarchy has always been based on the concept of a common good rather than the individual good. The tremendous complexity, especially of an empire like Russia in the middle of the 19th century, was simply beyond the average person. The average person should focus on exactly what he does, whatever trade or craft or specialty he wants to focus on. But in that very same vein, St. Philaret rejects the idea of rebellion. And I say in the same vein because, I may deviate just a little bit from him here. He says, you know, the commandment of the Lord, do not rebel against the powers that be. In other words, rebellion is a problem. He says, for those who are subject to power can themselves understand that by destroying it, they destroy the entire composition of the society and, consequently, destroy themselves. You have to be careful when you read. He uses terms like Caesar and monarch and crown. He's referring to a Russian Orthodox monarchy. He doesn't talk much about the 18th century where the principle of monarchy had fallen into disrepair. And don't forget, too, this is an era where the state doesn't nearly have the power that it does in the 20th and 21st century. That the tradition and the struggle, the legitimation of the crown can't be trifled with without destroying the entire edifice and nothing is usually put in its place. Because he had his eye on, you know, Napoleon many, many years earlier, he realizes where revolution goes. The license that it, and Hegel says the same thing, the license that it unleashes can only be put back through violence and force. Then Fillerit says, you know, when someone in authority imposes a burden on its subjects, however light and necessary, how easily murmuring is aroused. And again, this concept comes from a total lack of humility. How dare the state take some of my money? Now, St. Fillerit didn't live in 21st century America, where corruption is considered virtuous, assuming that they even use the term virtue, and everything is 4 stars. But in this case, we're not talking about a state. We're not talking about government. There's a reason I use the term regime. It's the opposite of a government. A government has authority. Government in the U.S., Britain, and Canada has no authority. It may have power, but essentially it's a front for BlackRock and the monopoly. And, you know, Ukraine, Russia in the 90s, the same thing. One of the precepts of natural law, Fillerit only hints at this, but I say it openly, is that the ultimate distinction in political science, as I've said 100 times, is between the principle of monarchy and the common good on the one hand versus the private good of the oligarchy monopoly on the other. That every government, of course, has stresses one of those over the other. And again, as far as humility is concerned, he goes on to say that when those who are subject see how power operates, and when that power is inconsistent with their image, with their conceptual apparatus, how swiftly do words of condemnation come out of their mouth? He's condemning the idea that people who really aren't well informed about what's going on and all the details about legislation, foreign affairs, whatever, they're really in no position to condemn, especially when you have a relatively healthy system in place. Everything has changed now, of course. So Fillerit has to be understood. I mean, of course, he's correct, but remember the context from which he's writing. The left used to talk about the right of rebellion all the time. Now they don't. And they don't because they are in power in every way that one group can be in power over another one. So when he was referring to government, state, crown, he's referring to one that has legitimacy, one that has authority. And that's why he says things like this. A government that is not protected by sovereign immunity, that is revered as sacred by the whole nation, cannot act either with all the fullness of its strength or with the freedom necessary for the organization of the public good and security. That's a very important statement. He's talking about monarchy, even non-Christian monarchy, because monarchy is a part of natural law, because it comes directly out of the father of the family. You had, as the years have gone by, many, especially Protestants and secularists, who claim that there is no commandment to love one's motherland. Of course, the Old Testament has many of them, but they usually don't know that. He talks about the nationalism and the sinful aspect of betraying your fatherland. We are commanded not to do this under healthy conditions for the same reason that we obey our own fathers. The state, if it's a monarchy, comes directly out of the family. Now, if he lived in the reign of Peter the Great, he may have worded things a little bit differently. But obedience to authority, not power, not just whoever happens to control. Being St. Augustine said, we talk about, you know, give the Caesar what is Caesar's. We're talking about a very specific form of government, not just whoever, you know, one gang takes over. This doesn't apply to that. This isn't just whoever has power. But it should be no surprise that Americans see it that way. And American Christians are so dumb most of the time. They actually believe this without any critical thought whatsoever. Because Philaret doesn't see really the heavenly and the earthly as a dual. Ontologically, for him, they're the same. Just one is a very weak copy of the other. The only time you really do have this separation is when you have a corrupt state or a revolutionary state, whether it be in the Soviet era or the American liberal era since World War II. Because Philaret states that nationalism is essential because it's closely connected with our own civil obligations and our own upbringing. Those who are called by God to be parents, whether it be educators, whether it be judges or whatever, that piety is at the center, and piety it derives from the power of the Father. We talked about that a bit last week. Serving it in humility implies that you already have a love for it. That upbringing, education, is as connected with the family as any civic obligation in civil society. But education, whether you're from Plato to St. Philaret, education is essential. Now, we're not just talking about going to school. Education concerns basic upbringing, the culture within which you're raised. Today, of course, because it's so vulgar, they're only talking about just when you're in a classroom. That is a relatively small part of education. Anything that's influenced you profoundly as you were growing up in your early adulthood, that is a part of your education. So it's not merely the school system. But it's only when those influences are healthy can you expect anyone to be faithful. And not just be faithful to the nation, but to be faithful to it when no one forces them to. To be faithful to it no matter what's going on, no matter what sacrifice is called of them. One of the reasons that the United States and you know, Ukraine has this severe desertion problem is because they're not going to die for BlackRock. They're not going to die for an alien regime that not only doesn't have their interests at heart, but hates them. So talk about the governing authorities. The word authority is should be taken very seriously. Now, St. Philaret, as I've said several times now over the last week, was focused on the war against Napoleon and the invasion in 1812. This is one of the reasons he became so political. It's not just that there's this revolutionary ideology. It's revolutionary ideology that can only justify itself through constant foreign conquest. And he says that the fate of states is determined by the eternal law of truth, which is the foundation of their existence and which, as they're established on it or not, speaks judgment on them. And all of which is carried out under the comprehensive juridical supervision of Providence. Now that's a preamble to his definition of what a state is. And he has several. It says, what is a state? A certain region within the universal dominion of Almighty God, separated in appearance, but associated with unity of the whole by an invisible power. He's talking about the same invisible power that organizes societies, and the same invisible power that has created human nature. So the more constantly, I'm quoting him now, the more constantly it keeps itself in the union of the supreme ruler of the world by observing his law, piety, and virtue, the more accurately it enters into the general order of his reign. The more undoubtedly it patronizes God, the more abundantly it receives strength from him for its preservation and improvement. Once, and I'm not quoting it, it's the end of the quote here, but paraphrasing him, once natural law and God and truth are abandoned, And essentially, this is a law that it could function on its own for a time, being parasitic on the older virtues. But once that generation goes, the state at best becomes just a form of punishment for those who have let society get this bad. So that's the most abstract definition of what a state is in St. Philip. But there's another one. He says the state is a great family of people. So by family, he's already talking about genetic connections, ethnic connections, and of course, held together on the secular point of view with language. This people, after multiplying its members and dividing its clans, could not be ruled, as in the beginning, by a single natural father, recognizes over itself in this capacity the sovereign chosen by God and the law. So there's a certain philosophy of history here that the modern nation derives from the clan system, based on physical descent, simply getting too large to be ruled over by an actual literal father of a family. But the principle doesn't go anywhere. We talked about the killing of the king ritual, which is the introduction of evil into a society. If that's foiled, and there is no killing of the king, the literal father of the family then becomes the spiritual father, and this is the monarchy. In ancient Israelite history, and Philaret talks about this all the time, you have a handful of good kings, and those are times of tremendous prosperity. Prosperity not just in financially, that's not really the issue, but in stability and basic humble obedience. Nature and natural law are essential here. There's a continuation from the father of the family to the father of the nation. And even people still refer to fathers of the nation, things like that. But to the extent that they connect itself to the family and hence natural law, the better off the state is going to be. So that second definition of the state really has to do with the nation, or even the concept of a constitution, not in the modern sense, but in the ancient sense. And there's a third. He says, state is a union of free moral beings united amongst themselves with the sacrifice of a portion of their freedom for the protection and approval, the common authority, the law of morality, which is the core and necessity of their existence. Now, don't interpret this as the liberal state of nature nonsense. Free moral beings aren't born that way. Being both free and moral is the result of good education and an excellent code of law. Now for him, natural law, law of the family, manifests itself in civil law, but for him, their civil laws are nothing but the interpretation of natural law applied to specific cases. And it creates a penal system to control for its violation. But it wouldn't make any difference if virtue, especially humility, is manifest in the population as a whole. And Edmund Burke was right to say that wherever, I think I said this last week, that wherever that external freedom is permitted to a greater and greater extent, the stronger the state has to become to then control the result. And what they knew only vaguely at the time was this concept of external freedom is profitable. When you have a society that's dedicated entirely to the consumption of goods and in fact assigns value to people based on that money or the goods that they buy, the regime then needs to stress external freedom, so long as they profit from it. So these are his three definitions of the state, from the most abstract to the most specific. And held together by what he calls the eternal law of truth, or natural law. The laws that you see everywhere, in every society, you know, with the exception of this one, that is it's deliberately an inversion. The sanctity of marriage, the influence of the family, the control of sexual license, the control of the merchant classes, the condemnation of things like, you know, homosexuality. These are not laws that a state may pass a law about this, but I don't need the law to tell me that the opposite of all of that is evil. I don't need the Bible to tell me that homosexuality is an evil perversion. It might be nice, but I never rely on it. That's just stating something that everyone knew was true at the time, with the exception of a few of the pagan tribes. And of course, in his conception of the clans, which was how Russia was put together, these tribal entities connected by a blood to a greater or lesser extent, simply becomes too large and the blood bond breaks. But because they're related, because they have a similar language and similar history, they coalesce to become a nation. So a nation is a tribe only by analogy. And natural law is connected to all three. A union of free moral beings, this already implies that they're both free and moral. Liberalism, when it developed in the Enlightenment, while they didn't say so explicitly, it has to be that in their state of nature, this is how human beings naturally are. Concepts of upbringing and education, it was very hard to see, Thomas Hobbes especially. But the restraint on this external freedom is not just a part of natural law. It's part of natural law because when you remove it, you destroy any concept of society. And everyone from Aristotle to Immanuel Kant, of all people, accepted this idea that when you want to know if a vice is truly a vice, universalize it. So if you universalized the rule of money like you have in whether it be the Soviet Union or here, you end up with a total lack of a society and the war of all against all, which is, again, how we live now. We're used to the Hobbesian world, therefore we don't see it as an aberration. But if St. Philaret could be transported here, he would absolutely see it. He would absolutely see it that way. But I've already touched on his conception of history and providence, and this is very important. St. Philaret had a more or less developed conception of this. And that there was a book out by Nazarewski called The State Teaching of Philaret, which I've been relying on quite a bit here. And it's been reissued not that long ago. As far as I know, it doesn't exist in English. And the foundation of his philosophy of history is, of course, providence, no different than St. Augustine. But St. Augustine and St. Philaret were living in very, not just different moral societies, but as far as Christian history, they couldn't be any different. St. Philaret lived in a settled Orthodox society that had survived not just the time of troubles, but then the 18th century, where it almost didn't, where it was almost continually under the foreign occupation of the German Freemasons after the move to St. Petersburg. But St. Philaret says, having connected nature with necessity and leaving man in the process of his own freedom, the great artist of the world extends his finger into the diverse tangle of events of natural and free deeds and the mysterious movement of certain hidden threads, forms, and it matches everything into a single multi-layered fabric of world events which time unfolds to the surprise of eternity itself. So what appears to us as chaotic, what appears to us to be, when we were in the thick of it, that we are, that we're just living in disordered world, which is becoming more dominant even today, God is in fact working out his plan for the world. One of the main jobs of a historian is to lay out the outlines of what that's all based on. You know, how do we know? How do we structure the historical idea such that we can see God's hand in it? St. John Maximovich used to say that the Soviet Union, while demonic, had a positive role to play because the exile organizations existed all over the world. Most of us would never have heard of Russian Orthodoxy had not the ROCOR, the exile church, set up shop all over the place. That's not to say that they weren't missionary-minded. They most certainly were. We have many saints in that regard. But when they're forced out of their own country, no longer taking the Society of St. Philibert for granted, it's really easy to be, you know, to get lazy when you live in a fairly stable system. You forget just how fragile it all is. Theology shifts. Because now it's a theology in exile. This is not what St. Philibert was doing, although, of course, he's cited all the time. This is how we understand providence in a healthy society. The Synod abroad, and to a great extent even St. Augustine, were placed in positions where we see it from a negative point of view. The Soviet Union shook the Orthodox world out of its complacency. It created an army of martyrs, and it created a brand new approach to political philosophy. Philibert only vaguely knew of these materialist revolutionaries. So, Philibert was a vehement opponent, it shouldn't come as any surprise, of what we would call like natural progress or the social contract, and everything else that that liberalism is based upon. Somehow, the destruction of the family is a part of the progress of mankind. They never quite lay out how that could possibly be, but that's what the American Empire is partially based on. Only that it's a very good thing because they assume that the isolated individual, the ego, raised by the regime, rather than actual education, is the state of man that's most congenial to them. They can't even say the natural state of man. Even the Enlightenment would use the word natural, natural right versus natural law. No, it's just the easiest. For us, it's the most utilitarian because we really can't control a people with a very strong sense of themselves. It's impossible. And in fact, that is the very origin of rebellion. This is why the invasion of the migrants, this is why the hijacking of history and political science by our enemies is so important. Lots of occupying powers, you know, Soviet Union, England and Ireland spent a lot of time torching the great texts and pulling down statues because a people who feel put upon, who have a strong sense of themselves, will be a very, very tough nut to crack if they decide to rebel. Isolated individuals, though, especially those in a virtual reality, all kinds of drugs in their system, these are very easy to control. Without an identity, there is no reason to rebel. On what grounds are you standing on? So events, therefore, are part of a broader plan leading to the advent of Antichrist, which is in our own era. Because if we don't live at a time of Antichrist, then the whole doctrine is nonsensical. It can't possibly be a coincidence that every ingredient of what Antichrist is, whether it be in the patristic writings, in the apocalypse of Isaiah or Ezekiel, and the prophets, other prophets, the New Testament, all the great writings and canon of the church, it has to be. It's not a coincidence. So the doctrine is false if we're not living in that era. And I remember years ago, a lot of the more liberal Christians say that, no, we're just in the beginning of our rebirth. Because, of course, if liberalism takes over, they have to consider it a positive thing. They want to keep their jobs anyway. Well, let me, this is a very mysterious quote from St. Philibert. And it's also very difficult to translate. He says, all the hierarchy of our language and the word goes back to God, Logos, as its source and prototype. all more or less permeated with his divine creative power, thanks to which the world exists to this day. Everything stands on what is set at the beginning. The word of God, let there be light, and there was light. And the same goes for every creature that comes afterwards. God is Logos, the word. This is the root principle of all things. Power of God, Logos of God. This is the deepest foundation of their being and their benevolence. It's not to imagine Logos, or the word of God, as like a human word that we utter, which coming out of our mouth immediately ceases and disappears into the air. No, in God there is nothing ceasing, nothing vanishing. His word, i.e. Logos, proceeds, but it does not pass away. The creative word is like an adamant bridge on which the creatures are set, are standing under the abyss of God's infinity, over the abyss of their own nothingness. The word of God is the savior of the creature from the darkness and horror of non-existence. And therefore, the very day of the Annunciation is one of the few days on which all the days of the earth rest, so as not to fall into one endless hell of night. This is one of the more metaphysical statements that Philarete ever made. Of course, he's very clear, you know, and this came up with the name worship nonsense. We're not talking about human words. We're not talking about letters on a page or vibrations in the air. No, word is a way to understand Logos. That is to say, the world of the forms, the ordering principle of everything, society included. Everything goes back to the beginning. What he means is that's where the prototype first impressed itself on matter. Matter being very broad, not just physical matter, but things like culture and education. Logos is the root principle of all things. Word in the eternal sense isn't something like we would utter. It's the very rational structure of the cosmos and every part of it. These words are in fact structures. You can almost consider them like a mathematical formula, expressing the orderly aspects of the natural world, the social world, all coming from the same source. And they don't go anywhere. They do not pass away. Logos is, a far more rational version of Plato's doctrine of the forms. The ordered structure of the world is what saves us from non-existence. And this is, you know, he's writing this long before they discovered DNA, which completely destroyed Darwinian ideology. The tiniest little aspect of the DNA, RNA communications, the tiniest thing is left out or is damaged. The entire edifice falls apart. You're talking about a massive amount of information, even in the simplest and earliest of cells, that had to have come into existence as the material world did. In other words, this is one way to understand the word, and probably beyond human understanding. Now, it's not to say that the word is identical with genetics. It's just to say that this is a proof of creation, or at least disproving Darwinist ideology. And without it, nothing could possibly exist. The DNA, the genetic background of living things is a fingerprint of God. It's not the only one, of course, but it goes to show the complexity and hence the necessity for a designer, even in the earliest days. This is an aspect of the word Logos, or the forms, showing themselves in the natural order. And there is no distinction, not essentially anyway, between laws that could be found in the natural order, we mentioned already, and these laws manifest in human behavior and state. The difference is that because we can be preoccupied with our own external freedom, we can be unpredictable. Animals, matter in general, are predictable. They can't help but be what they are. Because humans have that penchant to arbitrariness. This is where natural law is a little different from the law of gravity. Yes, they're both laws, but gravity isn't specifically dealing with human behavior. It's an impersonal force. But the state certainly is not. It doesn't mean it's not under the same law and the same quote-unquote DNA. As far as what justice or love is, versus how gravity functions. It's essentially two aspects of the exact same thing. In other words, and Augustine says something very similar, this is how history works itself out. The logos of the beginning has its so-called DNA or its essence that then develops over time. This is why I've been saying, and Ivan Illin says the same thing, Hegel is extremely important. While he was a Lutheran still, this understanding of history was extremely important. And this goes for things that we consider positive, things that we consider negative. They really don't exist that way because everything has been part of the unfolding of the word, unfolding of the form. The forms exist as these eternal entities in Christ. And we at any given time only know a small portion of it. But as the world that we're forced to live in continues to develop, we learn more and more about what's behind reality. Literally what metaphysics and ontology are. So that means behind all the chaos, there is a stable narrative, there's a stable force. And whether we're talking about how an ecosystem functions, or how important it is to have a monarch in control of an ethnic empire or an ethnic society, we're not talking about two essentially different things. This is the nature of reality. Revolution understands itself as a negation of this. Michael Jones, one of the reasons he said revolution is inherently Jewish, because it was Judaism itself, so to speak, that removed logos from the world, literally putting them up on a cross, but more figuratively, removing the content of essence from anything and ultimately bringing nominalism into existence, which is the very principle of decay, the very principle of revolution, which can only lead to someone like Napoleon or Antichrist. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.